Well, good morning, everyone. My name is Don Key. I'm an alcoholic. I also am a member of the Mahican Nation. We are a tribe. We have a clan system, so I was born for the Turtle Clan on my mother's side, and my Indian name is Tonkawambu. But I always thought I have to remember probably the most important name of all of those is I'm Don, I'm an alcoholic. So I have to put that one on top of everything. And I'm just very, very honored to be here. And I was taught by my grandpa to always be aware of whose land I'm a guest on. And so of the Native people here in Arizona, I'm honored to be on your sacred ground and with your ancestors' permission. I ask for permission to speak and to share the story of recovery that I got here from AA. And we had a very interesting journey down here. I was going to leave Friday night, and I was going to stay overnight in Taos. And then I have a daughter in Gallup, so I thought I'll have dinner with them. And then Gallup was there late Friday night. So, 25 miles north of Taos, New Mexico, I ran into a darn elk. About a 400-pound elk, they said. And, so then, slight change of plans there. So I did mess up my car. My Jeep, I got old red Jeep, 195,000 miles on it, and I was so proud of it. I had no duct tape on it. Now I got to put. Now I gotta give you a little duct tape. Here we go. Give me a little red car looking part, but that's all right. But I talked to my daughter and she said, Dad, she said, you want me to call them? In the front, I'll call them in Tampa. They're coming down here. And I said, you know, a long time ago, if I got to the elk and I was headed for the bar or a party, I'd have figured out how the hell to get there. So I knew I had to do that here too, so we just got rid of the car, so it didn't work out, it was really great. And so here we are. And I'm so surprised how big this is, how many people are here. Isn't it beautiful? It's beautiful. And we have been treated so well here by everyone in the area. And his food, first thing, I didn't even get registered in the hotel. They said, here, they sent me some food. That's the Indian, because that's what we like to do is eat. So we had a lot of food, and so that worked out very, very well. To get everything going here. I was thought about what I'm supposed to do here is to share my experience, strength, and hope. And to talk about a journey. When I left our reservation in Wisconsin, I never knew the type of journey I was headed for. And so I think there's this little story or saying I heard from the East one time, and it says something about a man takes a drink, then a drink takes a drink, then a drink takes a man. And that was my story. I never drank any alcohol until I was a senior in high school, because I was raised by my grandfather. He was pretty traditional, and we just was so busy hunting and gathering medicines and things like that. We didn't have time, and so I had a couple life-changing events. Me and Grandpa used to just hunt and fish, and we did it all the time, and. I kissed my first girl when I was 16, and then I had hunted and fished since then. It changed my life. And, then I had my first drink of Pabst Blue Ribbon beer, 40, a little bitty one, when I was a senior in high school. And the moment that stuff touched my lips, I felt a change. It wasn't two swallows, it was a fifth swallow. And it did something to me I was a very shy Indian man, and I didn't talk much. I just kind of hung out in the background, but once I got to alcohol, everything changed for me, and I liked the effect of it right from the very, very beginning. There was a man, his name is Don P. Don Prick. His name is Don. He was one of my sponsors. And I had, was coming in and out of AA. I had a very difficult time getting what was going on here. When I come in, I didn't stay sober right away. I was sick again. And, our guy came to me and he said, there's this Indian guy speaking up in Estes Park. He said, let's go up there and listen to him. And so I went up there and I hear this man set. And I saw he had this book in front of him on a table. And it was held together by rubber bands. It was torn. It was ripped apart. It was held together. And this man, he looked at me, and I looked at him, and something happened. In our culture, we have a way, in our language, we have a way to describe the spiritual world. Sometimes it's hard to describe that in English. But in our own language, we can describe things because our ancestors were very, very aware of the powers in the spiritual world. And, to describe what happened between me and Don P, if our culture talks a lot about interconnectedness. Everything is interconnected, everything is related. And so we're able to describe interconnectedness. So the first level of connectedness is usually done with one of the five physical senses. So you can tell when eyes meet, when you connect, you can sense that. And it can be done with a hand, good job. So you touch, that's physical. But when you, if you ever notice, you look at someone with their eye, and when it connects shortly, there's a feeling that it's off. In our language, we call it no touching heart. And you can tell that. You can tell when it's not there. If you've ever been married to somebody, or dated somebody, or worked with somebody, they're looking right at you with a little corporate eye, and you can tell that feeling's not there. Then you say, you're not listening to me. Oh, yes, I am. What I say? Then I can't remember what you said. So when I looked at Don C, our eyes met, and that feeling went. It's a feeling like becoming a brother. It's like a relative. We established immediately. And so that night, I heard him tell a story. And the story helped me a lot. And so I always I tell this story, I have to say where I got it from, because in our culture, like, if somebody gives you a song, then you have to say where that song has come from, so people don't think that it's yours. So you say, well, this song is given to me by, and then you say who that is. Or other ceremonies, or things like that. If somebody gives you a ceremony, then you have to acknowledge that it isn't yours, that it's someone else's. So this story wasn't mine, but Don P said I could have that story. And it meant a lot to me because it changed some things about myself in my battle with this thing called alcoholism. So in his story, he said there was this boxing mat. And in one corner in the black trunk was a guy named Alcohol, who was over there. And that was the white trunk. And I sat up in the arena. And I immediately was attracted to the alcohol. I looked at it and I connected. No question about it. There was a something happened between me and this alcohol. And of course, the people were coming in the arena and they were sitting around there and they were throwing popcorn and hot dogs and everything. But like they're doing these matches, they stay at the front row, they put a ribbon on this, it's reserved. And that's always reserved for your family. And so my family came in, and they removed the ribbon, and they went and they sat right down there in that front row. You always do that for your family, just the best view. It's a special treat that they get. So they come in there and they sit down, So when it got near time for it to begin, the referee called us both out and just standing there looking at one another. The alcohol had a big old smile on his face. He seemed to be really friendly. There was something about the alcohol I felt connected to. So the referee started explaining the rules, moving below the belt, and he agreed. And he explained all these rules, how this was supposed to go down. So we agreed and put our gloves together, went to down, and that's fine. So the bell rang, and we got out there the first round, and me and the alcohol were dancing around. You know, first round this year wasn't that bad. And then we threw a couple punches, I would duck, I wasn't in no trouble at all. I could see I was holding my own. And so second round, sit down, bell rang, we got up, and we got out there, and somehow, I don't know how it happened, but that alcohol is smoking a real lucky punch in the stomach. I felt it. It just kind of hurt like that, and it shocked me. And I looked at that alcohol, and he said, "That was just a lucky punch, it was looking at me." And that restored great confidence inside of myself, because I knew I was going to be able to do that. Because I had a lot of willpower. I felt I was always strong. So, over the next couple of rounds, we're dancing around there, and every once in a while, the alcohol was kind of, it would get another lucky punch, and it would sting a little bit, and I'd look, and that was a lucky punch that you hit me. Even a couple of times, I noticed when the referee wasn't looking, the alcohol hit below the belt. Wasn't supposed to do that, so there wasn't any rules. And so, probably about around 6 to 7, as I sat on that chair, and I was trying to develop my strategy now on how I was going to work with alcohol. So I was focusing. And I kind of noticed out the corner of my eye, I noticed that people started to leave. I guess they knew how the result was coming out because they were watching it from the outside. And so I got there, and I danced around, and I was hurting. My eyes were getting swell shut. And each time the alcohol would, it seemed to have more impact. And so, but it kept telling me he could whip me. And somehow, deep within my innermost self, I knew I was going to be able to whip the alcohol. It was a feeling that I had inside. And so, by the time round 8 comes, I sit down there and I'm just really focusing on the alcohol. And how am I going to whip it? And as I was sitting there, I felt this tug on my arm. And I looked down, and there was no people left in the arena, only my family. That's the only one who was there. They sat right there in that front row. And I looked down, and who was tugging on my arm, and it was my daughter. And she said, "Dad," she said, "Mom said to tell you, let's go home. Just climb down here. Come with us, let's all go home." And I looked down at my daughter and I said, "You tell your mama just one more round." I said, I got some Indian moves. I haven't used them yet. I said, "You guys just watch." And so I got out there. And I don't know how it happened, but this time the alcohol just pushed me, put me right on my knees. And it started down on me and said, "You can whip me." And I knew that I could. On my knees, I was trying to take off this alcohol. And by this time, I was kicking. The referee wasn't saying nothing. It's like he was on the alcohol side. And so the bell rang, and I was glad I got back to my little chair in the corner and sit down there. And I'm really focusing on this alcohol now. And I felt the tug on my arm. And I looked down there, and this time it was my son. And I looked at him and I said, "What?" And he says, "Mama says to tell you." He said, "Natalia, we're going to go. We're going to leave. We want you to come with us, but we can't watch this no more. We want you to come with us." And I looked down at them and I said, "Just one more round. Just watch. Watch what I'm going to do. Watch your daddy. I'm going to see what I'm going to do." So I got out there, and this time I'm on my stomach. I'm falling out there, and the alcohol is putting the boots to me, and screaming, and hollering, and kicking, and you can whip me. And I kept thinking that I could. if I could only raise my head and I could see the alcohol tendency, that's all I had left to do, was just to raise my head. And I don't know, during that round when my family left, I wasn't watching over there, but the next thing I knew, it was gone. And as I was looking at the alcohol tendency, I said, you know something, the alcohol's lying. I said, I can't flip it. So I called out that arena, and I knew I had some healing to do. So I went down to Barnes & Noble, and I got some self-help books. And I got me a couple of candles and some flute music, and I started exercising. And so I spent some time doing that, and I was getting in shape. And would you know, one Saturday, I got thinking again, and I remembered a move. So I thought, I'm going to just go back down there and see if the alcohol is there or not. Sure enough, I walked in that arena. There, alcohol is standing. He's got his arms on the ropes, a big old smile. And I felt the next picture that done to me. And I said, alcohol, I got him back. And the alcohol said, I knew you would be. Because I bet you got a move that you think you can make on me. Yes, sir, I do. So when I got over to the arena, I called up. Didn't even let me in the ring. He didn't even just put the boots to me right away. He fell down the side of the arena. He started stomping and kicking. And right away, I was put, you know, looking at his tendencies again. So I crawled out of that arena. And I knew I had to heal. So I went to a different bookstore. And I got some other self-help books. And I started different exercises. And pretty soon, I thought of another move I could make. Traditional move. So, I went back. Sure enough, alcohol was there. Just trying to let me get up on the rope to put the boots to me. And it was there I had this moment of clarity. I think in the book it says, we must fully concede to our innermost self that we have this disease of alcoholism. And I was able to do that. So on August 10th, 1978, I walked out of that arena. And I haven't been back to the fence because I know that darn alcohol is waiting for me. So, instead of going to the bookstore and doing those other things, I knew about you guys. I knew about AA. And I decided I'm going to go see about the AA, what is going on there. So I went down and tell nobody I was going. But I was in Colorado Springs at that time. They went from the AA meeting on Cajon Street. And there in Cajon Street, they parked the cars diagonal during those days. And so I scoped it out in the afternoon, 8 o'clock, I was down there. And I drove my car coming to that box where the AA was, and there was one car slot right in front of that door to the AA. The other ones were filled, and I could see them parking on the street behind me on the other side. So I thought, I'm going to drive around the block. And if I drive around that block, and that slot is still there, then the sign is supposed to go in there. So I drove around the block. And I come around there, and that spot was still there. And I stopped my car, and I got thinking. And I said, okay, I'm going to go around that block just one more time. And if that spot is there, then it means that sign is supposed to go in. So I started driving around that block, and I went around that block as slow as my rest car would go. Really slow. So we're on it, just kept it moving. And as you know, I come back. That spot was still there. So I pulled into that spot and I went in there. And I peeked in the door. I didn't know much more than I didn't know a lot about AA. So I peeked in the door and I looked in there. And my first thought was, I said, oh my God, there's all white people in there. And I didn't know until later on. I I was pretty prejudiced against the white people, but I didn't know I was, before I was raised everybody. There was this thing between the Indians and the other ones. And they had like a greeter there. Big old white guy, and a greeter, they greet you. And he grabbed my hand and he stuck me in that room and I had a cup of coffee in my hand and I sat in the chair in 10 seconds, it seemed like. And so I was too embarrassed to leave, so I sat there and I was strategizing. I did it. You know something? I said, it's only an hour. I'll sit here for an hour, but I'm telling them nothing. I'm saying nothing to them. So the meeting started, they've been going on in my mind, so I'm alcoholic. And when it comes to me, I said, I say nothing. So I decided I didn't say anything. So we're driving by. Finally, the next guy, I'm on his phone for one alone. And I don't remember a lot about that first meeting. I don't know what was said. But I remember a couple of things about that meeting. One was they were calling on themselves. They were saying how selfish they were and how self-centered and how judgmental they were, you know. And I thought, man, these people are really stupid. Why are they calling on themselves? Because where I come from, you're from nobody, nothing like that ever. You never scared none of that. So you could get beat up, you know, whatever. But the other thing that I remembered that I really disliked was the laughter. They would say something and they just all laugh like hell. And somehow they were just laughing. And there was nothing funny about life that I could see, and they was laughing. But the other thing that I walked out of there with was there was a feeling. Contrary to all my judgmentalness, there was a feeling there. And I didn't know what that feeling was for much later on. But that feeling was strong enough that I came back. Not because of that, but there was a feeling that was there that I couldn't get away from. I had to run into that feeling. I was walking everywhere. But when I came back this time, I had heard enough to know there were some things that I had to do. I knew I could not do it alone. I picked up on and needed some help. And I had a very hard time asking a white man to help me do that. But I watched this guy, and he was like an elder. He was the older man in the group. And he wasn't a saint at all. He was a very, he was about 6'6" to 6'7". He was a very big man. I knew he was an attorney. There was no doubt in my mind whether he was an alcoholic or not. He was an alcoholic. All scarred up on his face and knuckles and things like that. And I think he was hit with an ugly stick when he was a baby. And so I asked him to be my sponsor. After the meeting, he said, "We'll talk." So we sit down and we talk. And I kind of didn't like him either right away because he was sizing me up. That's how I felt. And he was like looking me up and down, kind of scoping me out like that. Then he started to talk. And he said, "You know," he said, he said, "I've been in here for 50 years. He said, "I watch the Indians when you come in here." He said, "You sit way in the back row." And he said, "You're coming just in late, and you leave a little early." And he said, "I seen one of you guys stay here as long as 6 months one time." But he said, "There's something," he said, "you guys are really weird." He said, "You don't get what's going on here." And he was talking like that, you know, and I felt I was really being, he was like sarcastic and really being judgmental. And he was like, "I just don't think you guys, you don't have it. You know, you, some reason you don't get it. You don't make it." And I don't know if you've ever had this experience when you were a kid that your dad got you like a puppy and you tease that puppy and you go, you rub it in the face to get it to grow. That's how I thought he was doing it. He was like, you just don't get it enough. You have been doing this, you know. He was like, just rubbing it in. I remember I looked at him in the eye and I put that question on him and I thought, you white son of a bitch, I'll show you. I thought I'm going to make it. So I said, well, what I found out later on in his wisdom is he knew about the only emotion that he had to work with me on was my anger. That's all I had. I was so angry. I had no feelings of compassion. I didn't feel. I didn't care. There are many things. I didn't have all of that. That's all I had. And so, it's like during the first pass of the steps, he's just like, just even just pissed off enough at him so I would do that next step. That's what it seemed to me at that time. So then he said, I'm going to work with you. And he said, I decided right now, he said, I decided to be your friend. Don't matter whether you like me or not. He said, I decided I am going to be your friend. And he said, there are some things I can, as your friend, that I will give you. And he opened up this big book of AA. And he opened up how many pages? It was 164 pages. He told me it wasn't the whole book, it was a small part of that book. And he said, if you are willing to do exactly what's in these 164 pages. You are willing to do exactly what's in these 164 pages, and I'll show you how to do that. He said, you will never have to drink again. This program isn't about slipping. He said, this program that's in these pages, if you do it, he said, you will never have to drink again. And I remember I started to tear up. I didn't let him see it. But I tried so many things to not think. I lost everything that I loved. I chose the bottle before everything. Grandpa always told me about the sacredness of the children and those things. That was what was supposed to be first. I was supposed to be willing to die for them. But what I did, I abandoned that. I didn't stay for that. The bottle is what I went for. And I almost died from that bottle. And I said, the thing, the assumption that this man knew, that he told me, never do you have to drink again. That's a big deal. If you're an alcoholic, that's how I was. That's a big deal. So then, he said, here's a pamphlet. By then I moved to Denver, and he took a pamphlet and he circled six meetings in that I was to go to. The seventh night was my own choice. So I had to go to these meetings. One was the big book study, one was the traditions, one was the step meeting. So I had six that I could go to. Then he said, you go to these meetings, you just say your name's Don, you're alcoholic, and you should go through nothing else, just shut up. So you got nothing to offer anybody to share with them. He said, you know nothing. You say your name's alcoholic, you shut up. And of course, AA is kind of small, so everybody who knew your sponsor is when you go, my name is Don, you're alcoholic. Big place to sponsor. We all knew who it was, you know. So I did that. And he said, the only problem you have in your life right now, is he said, is the step you're on. If you're on step one, you've got no other problems. That's the only problem you got, is the step you're on. And when I went to a meeting, no matter what that meeting was, I was to look at it from the point of view of the step that I was on. And so that's what I did. And I used to read that AA big book looking for the instructions that you guys have always talked about. And I could never find the instructions in there. In fact, that book was kind of the most boring book I ever read at first. But I didn't know where they were. So then he told me how the first 44 pages has to do with the first half of step one. And before I got into the step, he had me look at all 12 proposals. We call them proposals. He said, don't do anything with them yet. I just want you to look at each of these 12 steps and then you need to answer two questions. And you come back and you got to tell me the answer for these two questions. So you need step one. The first question was, do you want to do this step? The second question was, are you willing to go to any length to do that step? And I remember as he was telling me that, he said, it was his opinion, he had a lot of opinions, but he had an opinion that half AA never worked steps and stay sober. So if you don't have to work steps, stay sober. You don't have to do that. And I was having lunch at his place and he was just making a sandwich, peanut butter sandwich, and he was talking away, you know, and I didn't eat in the sandwich, and he said, you know, AA is like a banquet. He said, at one end, if you do the work, there's like lobster and T-bone steaks, and then they're going down the table, all you get there is like meatloaf and cheeseburgers, and, you know, he just kind of described to me about life of the recovery of AA steps. He said, way down on the bottom, this guy, he said, but that's where you get the peanut butter sobriety. And so I was really eating this peanut butter sandwich, you know, and peanut butter is like sticks in your mouth, you know, you're trying to answer, get it all cleared up or whatever. And then, you know, he's just like rubbing my face all the time. It's like jerking my skin, right? You ever go to a meeting like your sponsor is sitting there and they're trying to get you to look at them? You know, they're trying to find you that connection so they can look at you. And so I would feel that when you're sitting in a meeting, maybe you'd be trying to look at him, give you, you know, you do everything you can not to look at him, you know. Finally, you got to look at him, and I'd look at him and you go. You make that noise with his tongue, you know, like peanut butter. I always feel like jerking my thing like that. So anyway, I got into the work. And he had me read the first 43 pages. Actually, I had to read it 25 times. So I had to read it for a mark, you know, read it four times, diagonal. Because he said, we're what's up in here. He says, it's not remembering very much. And that's true. I wasn't able to read it comprehend. So I had to read it many, many times. And so then he showed me on page 52 in the big book, the second half of the first step. There's a paragraph there, and it has nine sentences in there. You're having problems with personal relationship. He had me turn that into a question, and I had to look at my personal relationship. We couldn't control our emotional nature. So I had to look at my emotions. Not that I got them, but when I got them, what was I doing? What did I do when I get anger? Did I run? Did I sit down? Did I judge? Did I get self-hate? Did I? And I looked at all nine of these questions, and that was the first time I got any sense at all about why I never got along with anybody. Never got along with anybody ever. Unless I manipulated or I wanted something from them that I could pretend. And so I looked at those nine areas, and I could see why my life was unmanageable. So when I got that done, he had me read chapter 3 of Gnostics for step 2, 25 times. Going to the meeting, just focus on that step, starting up until I had done step 3. And so when I got to step 2, he had me take those nine areas that I looked at, and then he had me make a little mini vision for each of those areas. So where I looked at my unmanageability in relationships, so I had to make that little mini vision saying, if the Creator had me getting along with people, what would that look like? With my children, I had to get like a vision. Not that I did not get emotions, but if I got angry, what would it look like if the Spirit would help me? Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could. And so I made the 9 little mini visions. That's how he taught me to do it. And he said, the steps are all interconnected with each other. They're not 12 separate things you do. There's a natural order of interconnectedness that you work. And he said, this vision that you set in step 2, that will be your spiritual wisdom in step 12. And that's all you're going to get, no more, no less. So I got into that, and I did as I was told. And then, of course, it comes time for the third step. And I had some problems. I thank God to this day, whoever's wisdom it was, I put God into understanding for that step. That was very, very wise to do. Because where I got my knowledge about God and the way of life was up in the reservation, and that at the boarding school, at the mission school. And so, the way it was there, there was one church on our reservation, then whatever religious organization was in the nation, that was what that church was. So they had a deal there, if you will. Your parents weren't interested in that church, because you got clothes and you got food, but before you got there, you always had to hear the sermon first, you know. So we all go there, we're in the kitchen, you know, and yeah. Different churches do things different. So you go to sounding off. You learn, you know, and they'd all be singing, and all the kids would be going like this because we wanted the watermelon and the cookies and stuff afterwards, you know. And then that would be that way for a while. Then it'd run out of the morning. It'd be empty for a while, and then a different church would come in. So the new church would come in, and they didn't do this. They did another thing, you know, like this, and they would tell you, well, you're lucky because there's ones there that you could do it, they're all going to hell. We're the ones that's going to help you a lot. So you go like, man, we left out, the right ones are here, you know. And so, well, little Indian kid, you know, get pretty confusing about what these adults are saying about. And I remember the ones that scared me the most was the nuns. They're not so bad now. In those days, they wore a thing called a habit. And they patrolled the classroom aisles. They had rulers up there. The new guys went to there. And they were, I was scared of them. You know, for a little Indian kid, a nun is huge. And they tapped your knuckles with that, or your head, you know. And we were just terrified of them. And it was like they were trying to teach us about God, you know. And they'd say, you ever been thirsty? Uh-huh. Well, there ain't no water in hell. And you're going, well, no water in hell. And you want to see God? Yes, sister, you betcha I want to see God. They say, you ever been burning with a cigarette or a match? Oh, yeah. Well, your whole body is going to be blisters. Ain't no water, and you're going to be blistering, I want to see God. And you say, you bet I do. You know, you just get it on, you know. But it was almost like you had the flames of hell licking your ass to see God, and that's why you see God was to keep them going to hell. That's how it appeared to me, you know, as a little kid. And so, I had a lot of confusion, and then I come here, and you guys are saying, turn your life over to care of God, but I don't think so, you know. And so I knew I was on that step. Wherever I went, I listened to that point of view of that step. And then I was in a meeting one time in York Street in Denver, and this guy came from California and talked about third step. And he told the story about, some of you probably know it, but to me I heard it for the first time, about the frog. And he said there was a pond and a sore frog sitting on a log in a pond, and only these frogs made a decision to jump in the water. So how many frogs was left on the log? And I said, 3. He said, no, 4. He said, that frog didn't jump, it just made a decision to jump. And he said, how that relates to the third step is when that frog makes the decision to jump in the water, then God makes him an orange frog. So you got 3 green frogs, 1 orange frog that made the decision to jump in the water. And I used to really confuse the AA because you'd hear this thing about the will. Well, I turn it over and I took it back. And I took it back and I turn it over and I turn it over and I took it back. And I turn it over. Jeez, it's funny. How do you take that step? No, you took it. And the guy said, you just made this decision to become Orange Frog. So let's say you become Orange Frog on Monday, and on Friday, you get upset and angry. He said, you're just a pissed off Orange Frog. And I said, oh, okay. So what happens on Sunday? You get pissed off and you're going to get drunk. Then you're drunk Orange Frog. And I said, okay, I understand what that step is. It's about making a decision to become Orange Frog. That was where my mind was at that time. So I went over to Frank that night, and I was all excited, and I walked in the door, and I said, Frank, I said, I'm ready to become Orange Frog. He just takes the step, you know. But then me and that old man, we got on our knees, and we read that. We read that first step prayer. And that was kind of new too, because where I was from, we never hung on there with the man. We didn't do that where I come from. And so that was two major efforts. One was to take that prayer with him, and the other was to hang on hands on our knees to do that. So when we got done with that, I asked him what next. He reached down in his center and he brought out a ruler, tablet, pencil. And before I left there, I was writing, I knew how to write a 5-column resentment inventory, 4-column fear inventory, and an 11-column sex inventory. He showed me how to go through that and how to do that, and where the instructions were in a book for that. So as I was making my list of principles, institutions, of people, one of the things that cropped up for me on there was one of my uncles. And I needed that man because when I was 9, 10, and 11, I was being sexually abused by that man. And at the end of that time, the abuse ended because there was a big beer party on a reservation. The fight broke out and somebody took a gun and was shot 6 times right in my chest. I remember when he got killed, I was happy. I remember I was not sad. My mother's family had, she had 16 brothers and sisters, and that particular uncle was her most favorite brother. And for a long time, it bothered me because he felt so bad and I felt so happy. And so I started to write the inventory on this, and I really, really struggled in writing that because I never knew. And I didn't know men were abused. I didn't know that they were sexually abused. And so I wrote this thing in this inventory, and it was very, very difficult to write. But he taught me when I wrote inventory, he said, write this prayer on the top of every page. God helped me to remember. God helped me to be honest, and God gave me courage to do the inventory. I had to write on every single page that I didn't. And so I wrote about that. I wrote about it to fears. That sexual abuse, it really screws you up. I struggle in relationships. I was always a runner. I get into a relationship, and if it got serious, I have a plan to get out of it. I knew how to run. I exactly knew what I was going to do when it fell apart, and I did that. And that was just my pattern. Instead of running, if I didn't sit there and know that the thing was tied back to things that happened earlier. And so I got through that. And I remember when my inventory was finished, I knew it was good. I knew I had all the dark fannies in there. All the stuff I sold, the sexual things, all of it was in there. I knew it was good. And there's one Friday afternoon come by, and I got that nervousness, that feeling like you get when you're going to go to the bar. That was what was filling me there. And I knew that night I was going to either sit up or drink. I knew it was going to be one or the other. And so I was able that night to do my fifth step. But I took the sixth saw, and I stuck it in my pocket. I ripped those pages out, and I kept it separate. So this guy that I fist stepped with, when I got done with it, he said, I'm going to make another pot of coffee. And I said, okay, well, I just wouldn't do that. You know, I read it. So then he started to tell me some of the stuff that was in his inventory that he fist stepped on his first one. And I'm kind of just got... It was a sickle. He was really sick. But in his wisdom, he knew I hadn't told all. And then he said, is there anything else like you want to add to what you got? And I said, God, I just remembered I got this paper in my pocket here. So I pulled it out, and I said, I'm going to read it to him, because the details on me, I'll tell on him. Here's a sickle. But I didn't know he had the freedom. I didn't have the freedom. And so I went through and I started to read some of the most terrible things that I had done and that I had participated in. And I struggled with it. He just put his hand on my shoulders and said, just do another one. Just go ahead, do another one. And I would call it, and he said, just do another one. And I got through the inventory, and when it was done, he showed me what I needed to do when I went back home. I was to review the first five proposals. And if I could answer those questions, then he said, in the fifth step, there's a set of promises. He said, every odd set of steps has a set of promises, and every set of promises has a condition. Withholding nothing, you get a cookie. Withhold something, you don't get the promise. Everyone has a condition to it. And so when that was done, I started to read those promises of the fifth step. You can look the world in the eye. I didn't know what that meant. I raised my head for the first time and did not walk with my head down no more because I could look the world in the eye. And so I went through and I got done with that. Then they showed me how to do step 6 and 7. And that was a lot of fun, the first time to figure out. I didn't know. It seemed like every time I go try to have one of those defects removed, things got worse. So I thought I was doing something wrong, and I found that I was. There was nothing for me to do. I was supposed to put the cake in the oven and let God bake me. I had to put pieces, because I kept saying, is he done? What's he doing? How about? You know, always looking to see how it was being baked. And I finally caught into it. There was nothing to do. Put myself in the oven and God take care of it. Of those defects. So I kind of want to close with talking about amends. I had this list of amends, and the way I was taught is I was to list all of the amends that I had to do in step 8. Elimination did not take place there. All of them had to be listed, and I had to look at and pray for the willingness of that list. They had to become willing to make those amends. And when I looked at, especially one thing where all, like I was around my sexual abuse, I thought, I'll never forget a son of a bitch. Never. I shouldn't be required to have those kids. And do those things. But yet it screwed up a lot of things. So, I couldn't become willing, and so I went to see Johnny Looking Cloud, and I said, I know that forgiveness has to take place, and I said, but I don't know how to do it. Then he said, there's four directions to forgiveness. In the east, he said, there's your normal forgiveness, that's like you bump into somebody. Oh, I'm sorry, forgiveness, I stepped on your toe. Then in the south is a type of forgiveness that's called forgiving the unforgivable. That one is harder than the first one. This would be like forgiveness of sexual abuse, domestic violence, whatever. Then he said there's one in the West that's even harder yet. You see, that's the one called forgiveness of self. Am I able to forgive myself for the things that I did? And then in the North, there's a type of forgiveness you actually do that act of forgiveness to set the spirit of another one free. And so when I look at that, I do like the Savi Emmanuel, I suffer me too, I'm sorry, but to forgive the unforgivable, I don't think God could do that. And he said, okay. He said, there are three things you need to look at in order to do this type of forgiveness. Two of them you can do, one of them you cannot do. So I wanted to, I'm going to tell you, well, what is it? He said, that's not how we're going to do it. He said, I'm going to talk to you and I want you to go think about it first. So he said, the first one is you have to recognize the place, the location of forgiveness must take place. And where it is, it's in your head. Forgiveness is not back on the reservation, it is out where it happened. The forgiveness, it has to be in here. Go think about it. So I went off and I thought about that, and it took a while also, and I understood what he was saying, because I thought, in my mind, everything was up on the reservation where all that happened. It was the location. But that's not where it needed to happen. It was contained within here, in my head. So I come back, and I said, I got it. So after I explained to him my interpretation of what he wanted me to do, he said, okay, I'm going to tell you the second one. He said, this one's a little bit harder, but you need to think about it. He said, when that event happened, when that sexual abuse happened, he said, you wrote the story inside your head about that event. You wrote it. You're the one who wrote the story. And then he said, if I know you well enough, he said, I bet you added a little bit to that story. And I bet you changed it. So that if you ever said it, you could get some self-pity and some attention and make it worse than it was. So he said, you got to know the location of it in your head. And he said, you wrote the story about what that event has nothing to do with your uncle. He said, it didn't happen. I'm not saying it didn't happen. He said, but you wrote the story. And it's in there. And so I went off, and it took a while, but I thought about that, and I understood what he was saying. I was the one who wrote that story. I wrote about the fear, about the anger, about the all those things about that story that was printed in my mind. I was the author of it. So I come back, and I said, okay, I got it. He said, well, the third one, he said, you can't do. He said, you don't have the power to do it. So he made me an altar, a red cloth, and some sage, some cedar, a cell, my eagle fan, and he said, I want you to go to the mountains. And there was a place that I went. It was sacred to me. That's where I run to in recovery when I got into trouble. I go to this certain place on the earth. And he said, and he knew I was still pretty new at it, but he said, I'm going to tell you exact words that you have to say when you go and you build your altar and you light it. He said, and you do this facing the west, that's the red and gold direction, like sunset. Build your altar and face that way. And he said, you say this to the Creator. You say it to the Creator. Johnny looked at Paul's second here to talk to you. And he said, Johnny Lippincott told me that the place of forgiveness is in my head. Then he said to Taya, he told me about I was the one that wrote the story, and I did. And he said to Taya that the third one only you can do, I can't do it. And he said very specifically, you got to use these words. You ask the Holy Spirit. God used those words exactly. He said, it's an instruction. And you ask that Holy Spirit to give you a new story. You in your own mind can't get the story, but the Holy Spirit will give you the story that you'll be able to then share the experience, but it wasn't my prison no more. And so I lived my medicine. Nice time. because I was so imprisoned. It would be like I wanted him to say, gone, and I go to the grocery store and buy a bottle of poison, and I would take the poison, hoping he would die. That's stupid. But that's what I was doing. I was the one that was in prison because I couldn't forgive, and I didn't want to forgive. And I remember when I looked at medicine and I asked, as sincerely as I knew, for the Holy Spirit to give me a new story. You write the story in here. I can't think it up. And all of a sudden, it started to happen. I can tell you the story, I can tell you the details, but I'm not in prison. But that's to the point where I was able to take that, and I went to the grave site, and I prayed His Spirit. I was able to let His Spirit go. And I had a lot of experience with forgiveness because I was so faithful. 23 times in a row, I went up there with that altar, and I asked for a new story, and I got it. Again and again and again, because I found out there is one thing that God cannot do, and that's refuse help to one of His alcoholic children who asks. He has to help by His own law. Otherwise, you see, there's no validity to that creation. I was taught to work these steps every year. Not everybody does. That's the way I was taught, and that's what I do. I found a great freedom in forgiveness, in the four directions of that forgiveness. I found that before my head sank, conjured up the story to do that, only the Creator can give me that story to do that. I think the book talks about the growing effectiveness. Eventually, I was able to add the culture. I could add the culture to this, to the 12 steps. We started somehow to do that. I now work with the steps in a circle. 3 steps in the east, 3 in the south, 3 in the west, 3 in the north. And when I actually do the step, I face that way when I do the work. Step 3, I face the east. I let inventory from the south. I do my amends to the west. And I do my 10th and 11th step to 3 to the north. Working in harmony with those 4 directions, with those doors, the way that Grandpa taught me. I found that my delusion that this AA program was the white man's program was wrong. You know that feeling I talked about in that very first meeting? I found out what that was. That's the feeling you get when you come home. When you come home to your people. When you come home to your kind. One time, I was on a rest, and I was up there drinking and drinking now, and I had a lot of trouble. My family took me to the edge of the reservation line, and they said, "Leave. Get out of here. We don't want you here no more. You're embarrassed and you're dangerous. We don't want to be around you." And they did. I come to you guys, and when you guys told me to keep coming back, can you imagine that? Whoa. See, that's a tribal thing. That feeling there that they trust you. Now, you knew I belong there. You sent it out and I could feel it. I could feel it. I come home. I come home to you. So I'll close with saying I thought the worst thing in my alcoholism, if I had to list of all the things that happened, it would be top of the list to be the loneliness. That loneliness, that feeling. Do anything to try to. And I found out what that feeling was the absence of the Creator in my life. It was God. That's what was missing. Well, I was the greatest gift that I have in my recovery. It's the relationship that I have with my Creator. It's so cool. It has been a number of years that I have not ever experienced, no matter what I've done, I have not experienced that God left. I don't know what that feels like no more. No matter what it is, it's always there. That feeling is always there. And so, I guess I would say if I had to have a choice between maybe my own tribe and you, I'm pretending. But if I had to have a choice to get kicked out of my tribe or leave you, I would have to choose you. You are my tribe. Thank you very much.